This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
So I'm a Green Party MP. I've been in Parliament since 2008. And as an out gay man, I was involved back in the late 70s and the early 80s in advocating for homosexual law reform, and then later on in outside of Parliament, working for the AIDS Foundation, advocating for human rights reforms. And then while in Parliament, I worked with particularly Lewis Awol, but some other MPs on marriage equality. And as part of that, part of the work that we were doing, we sort of became aware of this big group of men who had been convicted under the old law. And I made an approach to, at that stage, Judith Collins, who was the Minister of Justice at the time, to say, well, you know, how about it? Because these are men who deserve an apology and deserve to have these convictions wiped, because the law, in fact, was never a morally justifiable law. And she was interesting. She was open to the idea, interested in talking it through, obviously got some advice from the Ministry of Justice, and decided, I think we were probably a little too close to the 2014 election for her to take it forward. But I think that was, I mean, I'm assuming that was the source of some, of Wiramu Demchik, who's this Auckland man who really is the person who's driven the petition, getting the idea that we should do this. Of course, at the same time, there have been, you know, a couple of other countries who have made similar moves, and you know, I'm sure that was part of his thinking as well. That if they could do it, then surely we could as well.
So, how easy was it to identify those convictions? Like you were saying, there was quite a number of convictions. How did you go about that?
Well, no, we haven't done that yet. In fact, that's the principal task. In fact, that would sit in front of justice officials, or whatever the mechanism that we set up will be, to actually work their way through those historic convictions. The tricky bit, which is why Amy Adams, who's the current Minister of Justice, I went to see her when she became the minister after the last election, to pick up the conversation I'd been having with Judith Collins. And she had several particular objections. This was the law of the land at the time, and people should have been expected to follow the law. You know, that was one of her objections. The second one was that if an apology and quashing of convictions occurred in this case, does that open the door to some other groups seeking something similar in relation to other laws that have changed? And then the third objection, which I think is probably the most realistic of the three that she had, was the practical one, that if someone who was convicted of, say, indecent behaviour, which was one of the offences that people were convicted under, and there were a number of them that were used at different stages prior to law reform in 86, that there were other behaviours that attracted the same charge and therefore the same conviction that would in fact still be problematic today. So, for example, there was no distinction made based on age. So behaviour that we would still, in fact, probably more strongly classify as rape today because of a person being underage, actually might simply have attracted an indecent behaviour or sodomy charge. And so whatever we do is going to require sifting through court records rather than simply everyone who got an indecent behaviour conviction is now no longer has one. So that's going to be the main body of the work.
But I've seen in an article, I think it was on GANZ.com, where there was a number, there was like 879 convictions within from 1980 to 1985, I think. I mean, is that the kind of figure, that those are the kind of numbers that you're aware of?
I have steered clear of trying to be precise about numbers. I've seen that number before, and I'm not sure how robust it is. Certainly from my own knowledge, I mean, I remember the days of, you know, trundling along to court and seeing a succession of cases of men appearing to usually plead guilty, in fact almost universally plead guilty to get their conviction. So I have no doubt that we're talking at least about hundreds, if not thousands, of men. Now, of course, for many of those men, they will now have passed away, but I've been quite clear to say that I'm interested not only in the men who are currently alive today, but also the men who have passed away, because the consequences for men of getting these convictions were generally pretty catastrophic for their lives, and they had those consequences rippled out to others, you know, to their partners and friends and families, and probably have rippled down the generations as well. You know, Uncle Bill that we don't talk about. Well, actually, you know, Uncle Bill, who's now passed away, and his descendants deserve the dignity of an apology and for that conviction to be wiped.
So were you able to answer Amy's other kind of concerns? I think there were two other concerns that she raised.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think... For me, one of the distinguishing features is that the law as it stood prior to 1986 required gay men to act against their biological nature. And I think that places this kind of offending, these kinds of convictions, in a different category to convictions for, sedition or something else that was previously an offence and might no longer be. And so I would say these were laws that never ought to have existed because they offended so fundamentally against people's human rights. And I guess the thing that I would say about Amy's concern about precedent is, well, if there were other convictions for offences that were similar to this, that actually required people to act against their nature, then, you know, that we should open that door. You know, they deserve an apology as well. But as to this idea that, you know, even though the law, our modern construction of the law is that it should never have existed, nonetheless, people owed a duty of obedience to the law. My counter would be, actually, that's the very reverse of the position that countries like New Zealand took in the Nuremberg trials, where actually we said to Nazi officers, yes, we know that this was the law of your land at the time and that you were only following orders. Nonetheless, actually, there are principles of natural justice and human rights that trump the law of the land. Actually, that's, I believe, the principle we should be applying here too.
So what is this petition seeking?
So the petition seeks two things. It seeks an apology, and it also, in quite general terms, seeks for the convictions that were registered against these men's names to, I guess, be deleted in some way. Now, I'm not an expert in all of the mechanisms that are available to do that, but what I'm in seeking to represent the petition in Parliament, trying to do is seek for those convictions to be quashed or expunged, actually, rather than a pardon. I mean, to me, and I'm sure to most people, the idea of a pardon is that yes, you did something wrong, but the state has forgiven you for doing so. Now, I'm not sure that if I had a conviction that that's what I would want, because I guess my argument would be people who were convicted under those historic laws never did anything wrong, and so a pardon is the wrong construction. Quashing the conviction is the right thing to do.
And you would go for a quashing of conviction and an apology, not just an apology?
Yes, I would. I mean, I think my guess is that the aspect of that formula that would carry the most power and meaning would be the apology. I think a sincerely meant and appropriately delivered state apology would be a very, very powerful thing for those men. But the petitioner and his evidence to the select committee said, well, that's the very least that the state should be doing, and actually we should be going further and saying this should never have been a crime. That actually is also a really powerful signal. And there will be people around today who still have to declare, a conviction in certain circumstances, because the clean slate legislation doesn't apply in all circumstances, and they really shouldn't have to do that.
So what would declaring a conviction mean nowadays? What would that limit or?
Well, it might prevent someone being able to travel to some countries, for example. It might have direct practical implication of that sort. That's an example of a circumstance in which a conviction like that would still need to be declared. There are also some limitations on the types of offences that the clean slate legislation applies to, and some sexual offending still has to be declared. I've just been through the process of applying for a job, and they asked me about my criminal convictions. Well, someone with one of these convictions, if it's framed in as a sexual offence, which it will have been for most people, that probably still has to be declared. So that might mean, missing out on employment.
So have men with convictions come forward through this process so far?
I know of some who there have been one or two who've been prepared to talk to media, for example. So when I've talked to media about this issue previously, typically the first question a journalist will ask is, well, can we talk to someone? And of course, the reality for men who've been affected by this legislation is that for many of them, they have lived since their conviction a life that has been heavily affected by shame, embarrassment. And so talking to a journalist is often the very last thing that they want to do. So I've been really grateful to those men who have been prepared to talk. And the select committee has taken actually the extraordinary step, because select committees, when they receive petitions, typically will listen to what the petitioner has to say. They'll ask the relevant government department to respond. They might seek evidence from one or two other expert groups, and then they'll make a report. What the select committee has done in this case is thrown open the inquiry to the process to submissions. And I've tried to encourage men and their families, in fact, to tell their story. That in my experience, those personal stories of, you know, how this has affected me are the most powerful evidence that a select committee can hear. And so I'm certainly very hopeful that that men will actually take this chance to actually tell their story. There is a way of doing that confidentially if that's what men would rather do. But I think in the same way that during the campaign for law reform, our most powerful weapon, in fact, was our willingness to come out and to say, this is about me. I think that if men are prepared to tell their story kind of on the record and using their names, that actually that will be the most powerful way that we can actually convince others of the need to do this.
Has there been any opposition to an apology and a quashing of convictions?
Well, I have heard opposition from kind of the usual suspects, you know, Family First and some of the fundamentalist churches who typically have opposed every single step forward towards full recognition of our human rights, but not from anyone else. In fact, it will be interesting to see what submissions opposed to what Wiramu has sought in the petition do come forward. I haven't seen any so far.
So what's happening around the rest of the world in terms of this kind of apology and quashing of convictions?
Well, I don't know the detail of that. But I do know that that other jurisdictions and the UK is the one that I have the most familiarity with are moving in precisely this direction, and. We should be doing this because it's the right thing to do. I think actually the fact that others are taking the step might give confidence to particularly government members that they can do this without having to be leaders, which they don't seem to like doing.
And so why now in New Zealand? Is there a particular reason, or it's just the right time?
Well, I guess the right time was the day after law reform passed in 1986. With every passing year, more of these men have passed away, and I'm just aware of what a profound, not redemptive, but restorative effect that these steps will have for most of these men. So I think, every passing year, actually, it gets us further away from when we should have done it. But I think that with the 30th anniversary, with having passed marriage equality, which really was the last legislative hurdle, because actually adoption law reform is sometimes cited, but actually the reality is we're already there on adoption. So from a legislative point of view, and looking at the needs of gay, lesbian and bisexual people rather than at transgender rights, which still have quite a way to go, we're kind of there on the legislative program. And So I think the 30th anniversary, which many of us have been involved in celebrating in some ways, looking back, taking some pride in our achievements, but also thinking about the other side of the ledger, which was all of those who were harmed by the previous regime, and doing what we can now to reverse that harm. I think probably that 30th anniversary has been the spur this year.
I think I've heard Amy Adams comment saying that she would consider things on a case-by-case basis. Would that be something that you would go for, rather than a blanket apology and quashing? You would be a case-by-case thing?
Well, there has to be some kind of case-by-case process because of this problem of the conviction offences not being sufficient as categories to be able to distinguish those who are entitled to the apology and the conviction being wiped. What then arises is whether that's done proactively or reactively. And again, Wiremu Demchik in his submission to the Select Committee quotes the Human Rights Commission, who have had something to say about this, saying actually the kind of proactive respect and honouring of human rights always carries more weight than reactive. So it would be preferable for us to set up some kind of process that actually says, well, let's look at the categories of offence, let's go case by case through those convictions and say, this one is in, this one is out, and then extend the apology to everyone who was convicted for circumstances that should never have been offences, and then very deliberately case by case provide those that quashing of convictions. Now, the other way to do it, and it may be that this is what Amy would prefer, is to say we're setting up a tribunal, say, and the job of the tribunal will be to hear applications from men or from their families in the case of those who have either passed away or who are no longer in circumstances where they could apply in their own right, and provide the quashing of conviction on application and on the merits of that individual case. Now, taking Wiremu's point on board, you know, that actually is less satisfactory because there will be people who don't know about the process, can't manage the process, and nonetheless still deserve, you know, that conviction to go. There is, on the other hand, something of an advantage to that. I mean, a journalist whose father is a gay man said to me that he was talking with some of his father's friends over dinner one night. Some of them have convictions, and they have chosen to reframe those convictions as being badges of honour, in a sense. And so they were saying to him that they would prefer to retain those convictions. And actually, I kind of understand that. You know, while Amy is concerned about precedent, in fact, there have already been precedents. You know, there has been a reversal or quashing of convictions for a category of men who were, as I understand it, convicted of desertion in the First World War. You know, so there's been a precedent there. There's also been a quashing of the convictions of all of the people who were convicted of trespassing in the Bastion Point occupation in 1978. Now, I didn't get a conviction in 1978 for the Bastion Point occupation, but in 1982, I think it was, there was a reoccupation, and I did get a conviction for trespass on Bastion Point. But when the quashing of convictions happened, they didn't think about the 1982 occupation. And when I've thought about it, I've thought, well, actually, I'm proud of that action, and I do actually kind of wear that conviction as a bit of a badge of honour. So I actually don't want that conviction to go. So that would be an advantage of the of dealing with quashing of convictions on application. So there are advantages and disadvantages to the two different approaches.
So what is the process from here?
So the process now will be that so the Select Committee has opened submissions. We have asked the Ministry of Justice to supply advisors. So their job is to provide expert advice to the Select Committee. When the submissions close in October, we will start hearing from those who want to be heard, as well as, of course, reading all of the submissions that people have made. The Ministry of Justice will provide an analysis of the submissions, and they should also provide us advice on the precedents that have already been set, the options that are available to the government, because it still is the government that will make a decision. And then the Select Committee will make recommendations to the government on what it should do. I have to say that while media reporting has tended to focus on Amy Adams talking about the problem, saying this is not a straightforward process, my experience talking with both Amy and with Judith Collins before her was that actually I found them both really open to the ideas here. And that was my experience with the Select Committee as well, that members from all parties seemed genuinely well disposed to trying to be able to grant what Wiramu's petition has sought. And I thought, man, isn't that great, you know, that we've reached that point in our parliament where all parties actually want to do the right thing.
So it's more about the practicalities of actually how you go about it.
It is. And I'm confident that just as other countries have been able to find a way through the practical problems that are genuine problems, I'm sure we're going to be able to as well.
Today has been a huge day for you. Last night you announced that you were leaving Parliament after 8 years. I just thought, since we're here and it's the day after, what are you most proud of in your parliamentary time?
I guess the single thing that I'm most proud of is my work around the Pike River disaster, actually achieving a degree of accountability from the government and really leading them to a point where it became necessary for them to overhaul New Zealand's health and safety legislation and regulation. And I know it wasn't just me, but I can confidently assert that I led that process, and I feel really proud of that and providing a voice to the Pike River families and to the men who died in the New Zealand Parliament on that issue. So that's probably the single biggest thing, but there's other things. And I guess for our communities, probably the marriage equality law, where I worked with Louisa Wall and with Nikki Kaye, who I extend my absolute best wishes to in this time where she's unwell. And people like Ruth Dyson, Tau Henare, Trevor Mallard, you know, these were all people who worked together in Parliament and to achieve a great outcome. And my bit of that was mostly providing, I guess, the strategic input and actually try to steer the process as best I could. And I feel that went really well. So I'm proud of that too.